Hey, it's Kale. I want to quickly remind you that this episode has spoilers for JLA Earth 2. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Matt and Kale Read Comics. Every episode, Kale and I look at a different graphic novel. This week, we are looking at JLA Earth 2, published in 2000 by DC Comics, written by Grant Morrison with art by Frank Quitely. The story follows the Justice League of America, you know, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, as they encounter the evil counterparts from a parallel Earth where everything good is now evil. So instead of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman in the Justice League, this parallel Earth has Ultraman, Owlman, and Superwoman in the crime syndicate. In this alternate reality, Lex Luthor is the only good guy, and he crosses over into the regular DC universe to ask the Justice League for help. My name is Matt Smith. I am a Canadian and British cartoonist and comics educator currently living outside of Glasgow in Scotland.
Hi, and I'm Kale Wierke. I'm a longtime mainstream comic book fan, cosplayer, collector, and former filmmaker.
This episode, we are joined by not one, but two guests. We have, who better to help us unpack the graphic novel Earth 2 than the hosts of the Earth 2 podcast? Please welcome to the show, David Steele and Peter Watson.
Hello.
Hi there.
A lifelong comic reader, Dave worked in a comic shop when he was 21, and decades later, it's still the best job he's ever had. He's more into DC than Marvel on balance, but does love the Marvel Cinematic Universe. As well as co-hosting the Earth 2 podcast with Peter, Dave is also a contributor to the Doctor Who podcast, The Power of Three.
And Peter Watson loves comics so much he bleeds in four colors. He loves reading them, collecting them, studying them, selling them. He's a writer of the comic The Lang Walk Hame, based on his poem written in Scots about a drunk man stumbling home from the bar, desperate for a wee. The main art was done by Gordon Johnson and features guest art by the cream of Scottish small press talent, including past guests on this show, Chris Manson. I know most of these contributing artists personally from the Glasgow comic scene, and I think my copy does have everyone's signature on the cover. I think I managed to round up signatures from everyone who participates in it. Peter and I met through various events in the Glasgow comic scene and through Glasgow's Forbidden Planet, which is the largest comic book store in the UK where Peter works.
Yes.
Peter, I just wanted to ask just kind of a side note, what has life been like, or how has the comic book industry through the retail scene changed in the pandemic? How is it completely different in the last couple of months?
Well, to be honest, right now, the shop main shop is closed, but it's available for mail order. So people can still get things through, just basically ordering through our Facebook page, really. That seems to be the best way for people to go. But yeah, obviously it's a bit of a hit. Most of the staff are furloughed. There's literally like one or two people in on a daily basis, Monday to Friday, to deal with deliveries coming in. We're still getting deliveries. There's still plenty of things coming in, but we're still getting all the weekly comics. And obviously, you know, they're getting sent out to people. So that's quite a big job for, you know, for people to do. But yeah, once everything's over, we'll be reopened, and no doubt we'll have events back on rather soon. But yes, it's
I must have a fair amount of stuff building up for, you know, building up in my file by the time we get back in.
it's about
2 months, isn't it, coming up since we, because I remember when I went in last year after in July, after things sort of started opening up after lockdown, had a few months worth to pick up. It was great. Mm-hmm. Pile, it's terrific.
Quite a few inches of comics.
There probably won't be as much this time because obviously a couple of things I was reading the finish, but there'll probably be a few bits and bobs. I miss going into the shop, you know.
How long did it take you to make it through that stack, David?
Oh, I haven't read any of them. I probably read the issues of Shazam that were there, but that's probably about it. I'm so behind the last, you know, because everything I've been reading recently, obviously, has been the stuff that Pete and I have been covering for our podcast. So I'm so behind with recent stuff. It's terrible.
Yeah, right now we're both completely immersed in Silver Age, so it's it's a bit different from the current comics that are out. It's, you know, it's reading the MF Enterprises Captain Marvel is slightly different from reading Dark Knight's Metal.
That was my homework for a few days was reading every single Captain Marvel story featured by MF Enterprises, and that was quite something.
How many issues was that?
There were six comics altogether, but they were sort of double the normal sort of standard size, five or six stories in each one. We've got an episode due on it coming, you know, at the time of recording, it's due in about 3 or 4 weeks, so it might have landed by the time this episode that we're doing just now gets released. And it was a lot of preparation.
Yeah.
But it was worth it. It really was. It was great fun. I really enjoyed them. I wanted some more.
So, I mean, this is a great opportunity to then introduce the podcast that the two of you host. Can you explain it to people that might not have listened to it before?
Yeah, sure. Basically, it's we're exploring the origins and development of the DC multiverse and the legacy of the Golden Age characters throughout the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics. So, yeah, it's basically DC comics are renowned for having not just the one universe, but they had their cake and ate it, basically, and decided they would have multiple realities up until 1985 when they decided to get rid of them all. But we thought we'd explore how all that came about, because everyone thinks it started with the meeting of the Golden Age Flash and Barry Allen Flash, but it didn't. There were loads of crossovers before that between different universes, not necessarily what's come to be known as Earth 1 and Earth 2, but there are quite a few crossovers. And funnily enough, most of them were through Wonder Woman, which has been a complete eye-opener for us.
Yes.
We keep on finding these mad Wonder Woman stories that have got parallel universes in them. What?
We keep on finding them. Yes, I mean, we originally had, we talked about doing it for a long time. I mean, many years ago, Pete and I had been listening to an X-Men, still going actually, The Danger Room, really, really good X-Men comics commentary podcast, and sort of talking about it and saying, wouldn't it be good to do an All-Star Squadron podcast where we just do every single issue of All-Star Squadron, because we're both really big fans of the sort of revived DC Golden Age characters that appeared through the Silver Age and Bronze Age, and you know, some of them are still used to this day. And we talked vaguely about it then, but didn't really kind of get any further with it. And it was about a year and a half ago, I was just sort of generally expressing a general sense of dissatisfaction with my podcast listening. And Pete sort of said, well, should we just do it then? You know, meaning, shall we do our podcast where we cover... Initially, we were just going to do the Golden Age guys and the Silver Age and Bronze Age, you know, start with Flash 1, 2, 3. But then Peter had the idea of doing basically every other multiple universe, parallel universe, multiple Earth sort of story that we could find. Yeah. And I'm glad we did, because it's really opened it up. It's been really, really interesting. As Peter said there, we found that, I mean, not only was Flash 1, 2, 3... was not only was that not the first time that, you know, a superhero traveled to a parallel universe and met another version of themselves, it wasn't even the first time DC had revived a Golden Age character in the pages of The Flash. You know, we turned up all sorts of stuff about that. So that's been really, really good, because we're big fans of the stuff, but we're also finding a lot of new stuff ourselves that we didn't know.
I've listened to a few episodes, and you really go through like panel by panel, caption by caption, and you mentioned Wonder Woman. That was one of the episodes that I first listened to, where you're both reading out Wonder Woman's dialogue and taking turns to be the announcer, the narrator as well, in your best American accents and your best Wonder Woman impressions.
I've got quite good at doing my Gal Gadot voice. Wonder Woman is, I tend to play Wonder Woman every time that she pops up now, which is quite fun.
The caption thing kind of started when we were doing a cheesy Batman story, and I was doing the captions for it, and I realized I had to do it in the style of Bill Dozier from the Batman TV series, you know, meanwhile back in the Batcave. You have to do it like that, you know, it just flows out, so we kind of stuck with that.
Very, very early on, we just sort of did slightly Americanized accents if we're doing the dialogue for characters, but it's gotten to the point now where in advance of us recording, I'll get a list of characters for the issue, work out who's playing who. We'll spend a bit of time thinking what sort of character voices we want to use for them. It's very fitting, actually, that we're talking about the Crime Syndicate, because when we did our episodes for the Crime Syndicate first appeared, Peter decided to play Ultraman as Elvis Presley without telling me. So that was quite funny when, in the middle of recording, when that sort of started happening. But it's great. I mean, we have a sort of repertoire of voices that we use, you know. We can go a bit higher for female or teenage characters, and we both sort of do a sort of Brian Blessed voice if we have to do a sort of large warrior. So that's become a much bigger thing, I think, than we actually planned at the start.
Yeah.
But it's fun. It makes it fun for us, and the feedback we've had from some of our listeners is that they quite enjoy it as well. You know, it makes it. I think it's one of our USPs.
Yeah. And as well as retelling the story, we also do an analysis of the story and how the whole multiverse thing works, how DC are developing this idea, how they're using the legacy. Also look at how things are introduced in the stories and how different editors and writers and artists approach things, which is quite good. And then one of the things we are really keen on is looking at the letters pages from the time.
Yeah.
To see what the actual feedback is from the time and see how all these changes were, how they're being received by the comic readers.
The thing that I enjoyed most from the episodes I have listened to is when you spot future writers and artists that go on to work in DC or Marvel Comics that have written and been like, well, if you know, I think you should do this. And if I was writing comics, and then they do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a Wonder Woman one we did recently looking at a period of experimentation in Wonder Woman. And basically half the people that wrote in about it were future comic writers and artists.
Yeah.
Marv Wolfman wrote in, Irene Bartonoff wrote in, Mike Uslan wrote in, Mike Friedrich wrote in. There are loads of future creators that all had very strong opinions on what was happening with Mad Robert Kaniger's Wonder Woman stories.
Yeah, it was quite an eye-opener reading all the correspondence from the mid-60s about the Wonder Woman comic, because it made us realise that fan ownership of a character is nothing new. People go up in arms nowadays, and nowadays they do it on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, but in those days, if they weren't happy, they just wrote to the letters page.
Yeah, it always bugged me growing up seeing the letters page where it would say, because it was mostly American fans and American readers writing in and be like, New Buffalo, New York. And then it would be someone from Canada. And I was like, hey, Canada's the largest country in the world. Like, how come, so-and-so from New Buffalo gets their city and their state? We just get the entire country of Canada. Like, oh, Frank from Canada's writing again. It always drove me nuts.
I always remember one English name that popped up. Do you remember, Peter? The name Andy Oliver always popped up. That was the British name. That was a British name I always remember seeing in letters pages.
I remember Dale Coe. He was a frequent writer.
I know that George R.R. Martin used to write into, I think, Fantastic Four all the time when he was a teenager. Really? So there's someone, I'm sure you can find it online, someone's collected George R.R. Martin's fan letters to Marvel Comics.
I was at a con in Ireland a couple of years ago, and he was there, and someone brought one of his Fantastic Four letters comic, one of the Fantastic Four comics wonderful. With one of his letters in for him to sign. And he didn't bat an eyelid, because I think it's just a regular thing for him that people did this. Like, this would
weird
be something
thing
unique.
To sign.
But that was quite cool.
Well, I think, David, you mentioned that you've actually read the issue where they introduce the crime syndicate, who are kind of the antagonists or maybe protagonists for this story. Oh,
yeah.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Which
issue was that?
Yeah, we did. The crime syndicate first appeared in the 1964 Justice League, Justice Society sort of crossover. It became after the first one the year before, in issues JLA, issues 21 and 22 of JLA, I should say, became an annual thing. And the crime syndicate rocked up in the second one. But the interesting thing that we did was we did an episode before that which sort of demonstrated that the character names had actually been around for a while. So the Crime Syndicate has an Owl Man. So we talked about the story from an issue of Batman where Dick Grayson gets aged to adulthood mysteriously and then takes on the role of Owl Man for that story. Peter Researchman talked about the original Ultraman. We talked a little bit about the DC speedster character Johnny Quick, who appeared in the Golden Age and obviously then appeared in All-Star Squadron so successfully. So we were able to sort of demonstrate that although the idea of, of a group of sort of, through the mirror, evil versions of the characters, we knew that the names had actually, had quite a bit of history. That was quite an interesting sort of side of it. But yeah, they first appeared, as I say, issue 29 and 30 of JLA in the summer of 64.
Yeah, so they've been around for a while, but then, Peter mentioned, in 1984, was it, with the Infinite Earths crisis, they kind of said, no, we're just going to do one continuity and kind of blew up all these different realities, different worlds, and said, nope, this is the one true DC Comics Earth, and these are the only stories that count. And then, other writers were having their fun with some alternate realities, but Grant Morrison decided to revive this crime syndicate in 2000. Kale, was this the first time you've read this book?
No, I've read this book like a long time ago when the original like graphic novel came out. Mm-hmm. I used to frequent a library that had a whole like huge collection of graphic novels, and that's how I kind of spent my youth.
nice.
Yeah, so I read this a long time ago, and I found it interesting because I like the concept of the multiverse, especially the DC multiverse. I know that Marvel is kind of exploring that right now with the MCU. I think DC's like old school multiverse was like such a great concept to begin with, because it just was a way to kind of explain the different eras of storytelling, the Golden Age and Silver Age and so forth. Also, you know, have wacky concepts, right? Like I love the, I have a collection of graphic novels that are basically, you know, talk about like, you know, what if this happened? What if that happened? It's kind of like the, I guess, Marvel what ifs, but with the DC multiverse. And so that's why I picked it up. I was like, Earth 2, this is great. This is an interesting concept. An evil, you know, Justice League is freaking sweet. So I loved the way that they kind of handled the story. And I guess we can talk about that a little bit as we go along.
Sure. Well, my second question for you, Kale, is this is the second book we've done that's been a team up between Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely. The first one was We Three. We both loved it. This is the third book we've read, Kale, that's been written by Grant Morrison. I was just wondering if you saw any kind of commonalities either in the writing and the themes of Grant Morrison, or any visuals or panels that were kind of repeated or reminded you of anything we've seen before from Frank Quitely, the artist.
Yeah, well, I am a fan of Frank Quitely's art style, where it's very detail-oriented. And I, you know, we had this conversation before where we were talking about how much time he actually spends on these panels, and you can actually tell that, you know, while just like reading the book, and it just kind of adds a extra like layer to the storytelling. So I really like enjoyed it. His layouts are very similar to We Three from what I can tell, but I'm not a complete expert in that to make that direct comparison. But also I you know, speaking of the actual like story itself, I think it speaks to the early 2000s and let's say the invasion of Iraq or like, you know, 9/11 and, you know, the kind of reaction that they had at the time. So I see a lot of those kind of parallels now in hindsight when reading this book.
Okay, well, let's definitely get into the 9/11 parallels that you saw. David, what was your first encounter with this book?
Well, I read it when it came out. I was telling Peter the other day that I got my copy signed at a Glasgow Comic Mart run about quite soon after it was released. My memory at the time was that I was a bit about it appropriating the Earth 2 term, because that was traditionally a sort of associated with DC's Golden Age. I was quite fond of them. I should probably get this out of the way now. I'm not the biggest fan of Frank Quitely. I mean, I love the sort of technical side of it. His pages sometimes look stunning, that, you know, they're really, really cinematic and widescreen. Like there's one page in particular in this, which I loved, which was where Kyle, the Green Lantern, has basically holding the moon in the hands of a giant ring construct. I thought that was stunning. I'm not, Peter was appalled when I told him this recently. I don't like the way he draws faces. It always puts me off. It's always a barrier to me whenever I'm reading something that he does. But technically, he's fantastic. Technically, I can't fault him in the slightest. I'm a big fan of Grant Morrison. He knows superheroes inside out and back to front. And it was a pleasure to read, because his understanding of the characters is absolute. And he makes it look effortless, you know, the way he writes Batman and Owlman in this especially.
Yeah, I'm going to ask Peter the same question, but I did like his handling of Batman. There's some things I want to bring up in how he handled Batman and his dark reflection of Owlman, which I found really nice, because one of the things Kale and I talked about in our episode about Arkham Asylum, which was Grant Morrison's first run at Batman, and it's this one panel that I just can't stop thinking about. He shows up, Commissioner Gordon calls him, he shows up, and his first line in the comic is, "What's up?" And I hate it. I don't want Batman to say what's up. And it's just such a fundamental misunderstanding of how Batman talks. But I think he really has grown into the character. And I loved his run on Batman leading up to the death of Batman and then the revival of Dick Grayson taking over. So I do think that he has definitely grown an understanding of the character. But it's funny just how great it is here, where his first yes. crack at the character has him saying what's up, and it's just not what I ever want to have coming out of Batman's mouth. Peter, same question. What was your first kind of encounter and reaction to this book?
Yeah, again, like David, I got it when it came out. It's literally, you know, the morning of it actually coming out and hitting the shelf. I was a massive Grant Morrison fan, still am. Frank Quitely was less familiar with at the time. But yeah, I really enjoy both their works. I think Grant Morrison excels at two things in particular. I think he excels at experimentation and a more doing nostalgia, but in a very modern way. This book is totally a Silver Age story. Totally a Silver Age story. It's a very straightforward three-act structure, very straightforward, but done with a modern twist. This is 2000 when it came out, and that's when the term widescreen comics first started being used. You know, things like Warren Ellis's Authority, Brian Hitch, all that sort of thing. The Ultimates was slightly after this. But yeah, basically everything was bigger, larger, stretched. The whole decompressed storytelling thing was happening, because this would have been like a 100-page giant back, you know, in the day, because it is 100 pages, I think. But I could easily see Gardner Fox telling the same sort of story over the course of two issues in the 60s.
Yeah,
instead of hitting all the it's very much it's very much steeped in the Silver Age, and he's not even trying to pretend it's not. I mean, there's so many references to Silver Age or old fashioned comic tropes. It's phenomenal, and it just hits all those buttons for me, because I'm a big mark for that. And Grant knows his audience. He knows what people want, and this is the big return of the crime syndicate, who really didn't appear that often before. Then they had their first appearance in the one we've already spoken about in the 60s. Some of them turned up, three of them turned up for a couple of issues of Secret Society of Supervillains. Ultraman turned up for a DC Comics Presents annual, and then they turned up for Crisis in Earth Prime. And that was it until they got bumped off in Crisis. You know, that was it.
Yeah. Crisis on Earth Prime was the that year sort of summer crossover between the Justice League of America and the Page and All-Star Squadron. And that's one that I'm really looking forward to when we do it eventually. It'll be years before we get to it, but that's a cracker.
Have they been used since this graphic novel came out? Have they had a resurgence in the years since 2000?
Yes, but it's always kind of like been a different version. They did come out. A version of them appeared that wasn't actually these characters, but other villainous characters from the same universe. They appeared in an issue of Justice League Quarterly that Mark Waid wrote. I think it's Justice League Quarterly number 8. That was really good. It's a lot of fun. It's quite silly flashback Silver Age nonsense, but huge amount of fun. So they were in that. They appeared in a weekly series a fortnightly series? Was it weekly or fortnightly? Can't remember. But a series called Trinity, which...
I think Trinity was weekly,
It was weekly, uh-huh. Right, okay. They appeared in that, were quite prominent in that. And most recently, they were used quite heavily in the Geoff Johns Forever Evil storyline.
Oh, okay.
As well, and then it's part of the New 52.
They also, Ultraman appeared in a few issues of Superman in the 2000s. There was also another storyline in JLA that used versions of them. I think the JLA ended up in their universe. So they've been, it's an interesting sort of thing, because they also appeared in Convergence. Very much Silver Age versions of them appeared in the DC crossover event Convergence about 5 or 6 years ago. It's interesting because it's the sort of idea that they really could have flogged to death by now, but they've been quite sparing. You know, I would never have been surprised if they'd given them an ongoing, but I suppose it's the idea that, and this book does ask some of the questions, it's like, you know, what would happen in a world where the only supervillains really are bad guys? It's maybe the limits. Maybe I'm answering my own question. Maybe I'm answering my own point. But maybe the limitations are too obvious to do too much with them. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I want to get into this too. Just sort of the strict rules, or maybe not strict rules, of a mirror universe, and how far does this sort of hold up, and how far is it stretched where it's an exact opposite? But I do just want to say, Peter, you brought this term widescreen comics, and back when Kale and I first met in film school, he had a whole bunch of comics that were very much of the time. This was around 2000. We graduated in 2004. And Kale, you had like the Ultimates and Ultimate X-Men, and these were very much what they call widescreen comics. And it gets that, you know, it's just really big, exciting panels, and just much fewer panels. And this, you also use this term, Peter, decompressed. And so I thought it'd be interesting to ask you guys, because it is told in such a decompressed way, where like the Golden Age comics that you're reading, the Silver Age comics you're reading for your podcast, so much happens on one page, in one issue, in one panel even. There's like a whole range of emotions. Whereas here, I counted, there's so many splash pages. There's so many pages where it's just one image, and the first page is just one single image of the crime syndicate's evil moon base. The second page and the fourth page have four panels on the page. The third page has five. And then there's another splash page of Alexander Luthor stepping out of his pod. And then there's a two-page splash page of the Justice League in action. So across the first seven pages, there's an average of 2.25 panels per page.
But also, it forces you to read it at a certain rate. So it's almost like, this is how long, if it was a movie, it's like, this is how long we're going to focus in this shot. This is how long we're going to focus in this shot. It really does force you to read it in a different way than in the old-fashioned comics. You would read it and you could spend as much time as you wanted in each panel, whereas this one kind of like almost forces you to spend more time on different images.
Yeah,
and definitely tells you what images mean more, you know, like
it definitely dictates you mentioned what you get per page. But I mean, just thinking about what Dave said about feeling like the price was too steep for the book, I felt that way. We talked about this in We Three. You know, you can read We Three if you're just reading the captions and the speech balloons. You could read that in, you know, 10 minutes, because there's not a lot of dialogue, not a lot of writing, because it is so much visual storytelling. And this book too, there's just so many pages where it's like, oh, Superman, Wonder Woman, and Martian Manhunter flying. That's two whole pages.
There's one thing we found doing our podcast is that is the sort of change between Pete and I've talked quite a lot about telling rather than showing. A lot of what's going on, and especially some of the issues that we've recorded recently, the dialogue and the captions do a lot more of the lifting than the artwork. We did an issue of Aquaman quite recently, which took us much longer to get through in the record because it was much more visual than a lot of stuff we were used to. We were used to, you know, dialogue and captions covering it, and I was sitting there going, right, okay, you know, Cardi has packed in a lot here. I'm going to have to try and describe it so the listeners can pick up on what's going on, you know. And it's interesting, comics have got a lot more like that, I think, a lot more visual, which is great, because as you know, Peter makes the point, they are a very cinematic, you know, experience, you know, because you're reading and you're seeing at the same, you know, you're receiving a lot of information at the same time. I'm not a fan of decompressed storytelling, to be honest. I get quite dissatisfied with a lot of modern comics, because you know, you can read it in 5 minutes. And it's always a lot of things now are written for the written for the trade, written for the book market. And I miss the I recently reread all of James Robinson's Starman, which ran, you know, through the 90s and at the start of the noughties. And I was stunned at how compressed that was in comparison to even just some more stuff that was coming out around about the same time when it finished. He packed so much into every issue, and I feel comics kind of I think they're better when they're a bit more compressed. You know, it's a bit more satisfying, I think.
I do like a book that lasts me more than just my bus ride home from the comic book store. Kale, what's your opinion? Because I always think of you, Kale, as the guy who came over to my house with this stack of very much decompressed Ultimate comic books. What's your opinion on decompressed storytelling, the kind of widescreen revolution of the early 2000s?
I grew up in that era, so I kind of enjoyed that because I mean, like Matt and I, we went to film school. Like I was a big cinephile. I am a big cinephile. So it, for me, it just kind of fit that mold that I needed, like, you know, just big storytelling. And Matt and I talk about this all the time, where Matt has gotten into more indie books that are slower, that have more compressed storytelling style. And I'm not quite into that quite yet, you know, like it takes a specific type of book to kind of get me into it. So I like the visuals as much as the storytelling. You know, comics, it's just one of those mediums where you know, as Dave was saying, like you're reading and you're looking at the visuals and you're kind of filling those gaps in between and you're putting the story together in your head. And that's something I think is kind of powered by the power of the image.
For sure. Definitely. So let's jump into this book in particular. Kale, what was your opinion? What are your thoughts on the writing in general? Do you have anything specific that you really enjoyed? Is there anything that you found stronger or weaker?
Yeah, so the theme of, you know, I mentioned this earlier when I was talking about the book, is that the way that kind of America maybe looked at itself at maybe back then in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, I'm thinking of like when America went to Somalia or try to, you know, like interfere in internal divisions or whatever, and then kind of save the day, you know, quote unquote, save the day. So I felt that that was kind of hinted in this book where, you know, the Justice League goes to Earth 2 and then they try to save Earth 2 in the same way that they kind of have been doing for a while. And then they realize that Earth 2 runs in a completely different way to Earth 1, where Earth 1 is more hopeful and people are willing to change, but in Earth 2, people are more negative and they are just basically looking out for themselves, right? And so I enjoyed that. I was just like, oh yeah, I mean, I can, you know, as a kid who grew up in the 90s and 2000s, I saw that like happen all the time in the States. So I saw that, okay, yeah, like it's good to have another point of view about things before you kind of dive straight in and go like, all right, we're going to fix everything for you. Well, do you really need to fix everything? Or is there ways to actually go about things a little bit smarter? So I saw that and I really loved that about the storytelling.
I never made that connection, Kale, until you just brought it up that they are very much. And again, bringing back to our film school, you know, Kale and I saw Team America World Police in film school, and this book came out before 9/11. And Team America came out after 9/11, where it was really poking fun at this idea of, you know, the very well-meaning, very idealistic Americans thinking that they know best and going into countries where they're, you know, it's different ideals, like you said. And this is very much, the Justice League thinking that, no, we're always right. We're always just. We're the Justice League. And they go to a place where it just fundamentally doesn't work, their approach. And you're blowing my mind, Kale. Yeah. David, what's your sort of... Do you have any, I mean, that's a hard insight to follow. Do you have anything that's that kind of blew your
mind?
There
was lots of, what I liked about it the most was the sort of mirror it held up to the established sort of continuity or the sort of continuity tropes. Like the, we see a Jimmy Olsen, who's a creepy little worm, completely sort of submissive to Lois Lane, who's this very sexualized Superwoman who far more than Wonder Woman has ever been. There's a little background detail in the Crimes I think it's based when you see some statues, and I'm not sure if it's dead heroes or people they'd killed, but there's a very famous DC character called Dr. Midnight. So in a statue in a glass case, this guy was called Dr. Noon, which I thought was a lovely little detail. I've written it down because I couldn't remember. Instead of Black Canary, there was a white cat, you know? That stuff like that I really liked. It kind of goes back to what we're saying about how I think Grant has an absolute understanding of superheroes. So he knows the sort of stuff to put in like that, that, you know, that people like me, the old folk like me, will really like. And also I should say the sort of inversion of the traditional sort of relationships in Gotham City between, you know, Jim Gordon and the Wayne family and all that sort of stuff. That was the stuff that I really looked for, because I think the best things about alternate reality stories, even if you're just looking at the surface like that, are spotting the differences, you know. So as well as the story, which everything Kale's saying is absolutely true, it's interesting to sort of consider that. I mean, that's not something that I would have considered immediately, but when he says, you know, it's definitely all there. For me, the big joy in this sort of thing is spotting the difference and seeing, you know, what's different to what we normally have.
Yeah, on that note, though, I just have a general question for the three of you. It's set up as like, okay, this is our exact opposite. Everything, you know, up is down, black is white, good is evil. But in this alternate reality, and also, you know, it's interesting too that the reality that we know, like the regular DC universe with Superman and Batman, that's the one that's called Earth 2. So yeah. I thought that was interesting as well, that I'm going to go through. But just, I guess this all ties together. So if you read the back of the book, it's really kind of interesting because the blurb at the back, and I'll just read from it, it's very much from the point of view of the crime syndicate. And that kind of clicked for me. I reread it for this podcast, and then I kind of went back, and then I was thinking about it, and the ending is kind of odd. And then I kind of realized, no, Grant Morrison is really kind of positing the crime syndicate as the protagonist. And it's really set from, it starts in their world, it ends in their world.
Yeah.
So really his point of view is seeing everything through their eyes. So if you read the back of the book, it says they are the world's greatest supervillains: Ultraman, Owlman, Superwoman, Power Ring, and Johnny Quick, the legendary crime syndicate of America. Nothing has ever seriously threatened the global corruption they proudly enforce. But now a twisted mirror image of the CSA has arrived from the flip side of reality. Can anything stop this so-called Justice League, or will the stable, perfect evil of Earth fall victim to the tyranny of law, righteousness, and freedom? And that, I think, number one, is a big clue that Grant Morrison is really kind of inverting and saying, okay, no, things work in this reality because evil is just and evil is always going to come out on top. But the thing that just kind of trips me up is he set up this idea that there's like, everyone's got like their exact opposite. But number one, that means that everything had to happen kind of, you know, the Waynes had to meet and have kids, and Lois Lane's parents had to meet and have kids. So everything had to happen.
Yep.
But also in this reality, Commissioner Gordon is now a crime boss. And then the commissioner of police in Gotham is Thomas Wayne, Bruce Wayne's father, Batman's father. And Owlman is not evil Bruce Wayne. It's his son, his brother, Thomas Wayne Jr., who he doesn't have in the regular continuity. So already that's not quite a connection. But if everything's opposite, does that mean if Thomas Wayne had not died, because Bruce Wayne became Batman because he saw his parents, Thomas and Martha Wayne, shot in front of him, and then he decided to become Batman to make sure no one would have to live through this pain. But if he's good in the bad reality, does that mean if he had survived and become an old man in our reality, would Dr. Wayne be an evil guy? Like, that doesn't...
See, that's one of the great things about this book, is the fact that it just gives you enough to make you ask questions like that. It doesn't, if it spoon-fed you absolutely every detail, then we wouldn't be having these discussions today. That's one of the things I love about this type of reality. Originally, in the prefaced universe, it's called Earth 3, but this is just the antimatter universe in this one. But it's more kind of like a twisted, corrupt version as opposed to an exact opposite. But as you said, everything kind of still has to happen. In the original DC continuity, Bruce Wayne did have a brother, Thomas, in a story that most people say didn't happen, because spoilers, his brother comes back and kind of sort of dies, and Dead Man takes over his body because his brother's evil, and Dead Man lives a peaceful, happy life in his body until for all eternity, so to speak. But then someone decided, we can't do that. So they bring him back and get rid of the whole situation. Then everyone forgot about it up until I think Scott Snyder brought him back. Yeah, I mean, when Clark goes to Daily Planet in his cunning disguise of wearing a moustache, way before Henry Cavill thought about it, when he goes there, he bumps into Cat Grant. And the Cat Grant equivalent he meets there is horrible, because she's completely gaunt and anorexic, massive, massive hair, ridiculous boob job. It's like, but she thinks she looks amazing. She thinks she's incredible. But basically, it's the extreme of like of that type of self-obsessed look. It's the extreme version of that, because Cat Grant in the main continuity is quite glam, quite self-obsessed. But it's just Grant twisting it and making it a more extreme version, and it's fantastic.
And so a little homophobic.
What, the Cat Grant one?
The evil Cat Grant is a little homophobic in this version as well.
Yeah, well, it's
evil.
Marriage to Queen Bitch, turn you gay. Yeah.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that line. Yes. It's fascinating. But again, things like other parallels as well, was like you mentioned, Matt, earlier on about Luther arriving. And when he does, it's basically a parallel of Clark Kent's you know, spaceship crashing to Earth and being found by the Kents.
Yeah, when Alexander Luther crosses over from the evil reality to the new one, it's a couple driving at night outside of a farm, and then this pod comes down, and then out steps this fully grown Lex Luthor instead of the baby Superman, Kal-El. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's just so many, just as I said, all the nuggets that he puts in there, things like the Crime Syndicate touching their logos to, you know, activate their signal devices. That, again, that was an old Silver Age Justice League thing where they would have, you know, the Justice League signal device would be like the Superman shield or the Batman symbol, or they would press that and be able to like call an emergency meeting or summon the Justice League.
Star Trek Next Generation, I found, like tapping the emblem.
Yeah, but it's just nuggets like that. They're just throwaways, but they're all just adds layers and layers and layers because he knows his stuff. And Ben draws it so well. It's just ridiculously good.
I like it. I really like the spot the differences. I like that it rewards. I think it does, you know, it's, I think it's a really fun adventure, even if you're not well-versed, but I think people who, I mean, whether you've got this entire breadth of knowledge of Silver Age and Golden Age, or even you've just are kind of have read a bunch of comics, there's all these little things and just seeing like what is different. And, you know, Lois Lane is the Superwoman. She's like the Wonder Woman equivalent, you know, how they portray Jimmy Olsen, but the, I had a question. Oh, I was kind of confused by the ending. Kale, you said you had opinions about the ending. I wanted to ask, because, I mean, how would you even explain the ending?
Well, I didn't quite like the ending that much because they used Brainiac as like the big bad. What I was kind of hoping for while reading this book was a real like smackdown between the two teams. But you know, I understand like they needed a third villain to kind of bring them together, and then to kind of come to like an uneasy truce, I suppose. Just because I did mention that, the negative universe, Earth 2 uses, they basically act different. People are different. So like expecting all the, you know, the Justice League to go and actually save these people is kind of unrealistic because that's not what they want. They want to live in their kind of, their way. And there wasn't enough of an impact by the Justice League to kind of make me feel like they actually achieved anything.
Yeah. It's interesting. They just kind of played tourists for a while. I don't know, Dave, what do you think about the ending and how they kind of wrapped everything up by not doing anything? Well,
What I like, one thing I did like was Brainiac popping up, because the whole, a big thing that happened in Silver Age and Bronze Age, I know Peter's a big fan of it, is the Brainiac Lex Luthor team. So I'm sure that was a reference to that. What I liked about it, I liked the ending, because to me, actually, kind of, it felt almost like it had two endings. The natural ending was what I think when the JLA realized that they couldn't actually do anything that would change permanently, and the only way to kind of fix all this was if everyone just went back to where they started. I like that. That was quite, it kind of undercut maybe expectations. But again, by having this extra sort of additional sort of end sequence, you then have the bit when our Superman admits that he can't kill Brainiac, but once they swap back, Ultraman is quite happy to do it. So that was I liked as well, because it's sort of it's further demonstration of how that, you know, how their characters were different. But it was weird.
Kale and I have talked so much about how like Batman doesn't kill, but he'll set up this sequence of events that will definitely kill people. So Superman's like, I can't kill you, Brainiac. I'm going to go now and my evil counterpart will come and then definitely kill you. Is that not the same thing as just doing it yourself? Just with that's murder with extra steps.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And a lot of people, I've heard that sort of said about a lot of sort of fictional characters. Like, you know, Pete and I are both big Doctor Who fans, and a lot of the times the chat about Doctor Who is, or the Doctor, there's always controversy anytime the Doctor picks up a gun. But then you think, well, how many times has he convinced other people to blow things up, or how many, you know, bat monsters or scientists or soldiers has he convinced to sacrifice himself? What did you think of the ending then, Pete?
I really enjoyed it, to be honest. I think because it was literally, I love the twist, just basically the moment of realization where it's like, oh, it's actually all Brainiac's doing. And also, it's old-fashioned Silver Age-looking Brainiac with a pink shirt, not like the big metal Brainiac. He looks as ineffectual as he ever possibly could look, and yet he's the big bad. I love that. Another lovely twist. But yeah, it was good because suddenly it was actually really late on when that twist happened, because you had already had them cross over the Earths at that point. And it was really late on when that actually happened. And it just ramped everything up. As I said, it's the whole thing's paced in like a movie. There should be a score for reading this. It'd be great. Because really, that'd be the at that point, you know, that's exactly what would be happening. But yeah, so that happens. And as Dave said, you know, Superman came to the realization, we can't do anything here. We're ineffectual on this world. They can do something. Everything we're doing is just falling apart anyway. We should go back and tend to our own world. And then obviously the crime syndicate on Earth 2, or our Earth, then they kind of come to the same realization that, yeah, we can do a bit of damage, but nothing's really happening here. We're never going to succeed. We're really successful back there. It was the inevitability of it all, is they kind of like had to go back. They are opposites. You know, they have to be, they have to switch. They can't thrive in, you know, the other environment. It kind of had to happen, but just changing it to Brainiac and making it that, yeah, I have to destroy everything in order to basically elevate to godhood, get the energy to elevate to godhood, and see. I love the detail that Vin did in the panel where you've got Lex Luthor pleading with Brainiac, saying, but billions will die, and just the look in his eyes, the actual pleading and the disbelief that he says to him right at the end, but you're doing this, billions will die, and Brainiac's like, I'm elevating to godhood, it doesn't matter, you mean nothing to me. Insects, it's almost like that, you know, it's just so, so good. And, you know, the most intelligent man in the world has stood there in his power armor after trying to get all these dominoes to topple, the rug completely pulled from under him by discovering that Brainiac was behind the whole thing. And he missed it. He didn't see it happening. And yeah, he was losing at that point. And literally he lost not just his world, but an entire opposite, an entire world of other people, other civilizations, everything. It's insane. Mega high stakes.
Brainiac's always, I don't know. I mean, I'm not the biggest Superman fan, but Brainiac's interesting because his whole thing is he wants to collect all the information about a world, and then he doesn't want any new information to come. So then he has to destroy the world. And for me, it's always kind of connected to being like a comic book fan. Like you want to kind of catch up, but there's no way to ever read everything. There's no way to ever complete it, because even if you've started and you catch up next month, there's going to be a whole nother issue, or a character like Batman or Spider-Man, there's going to be four new issues of that same character. So sometimes I just want to say, no, it's done. I've done it all. There is no more. I've read them all. I'm a completist, and don't think about how maybe it's also confronting my own mortality with being a comic book fan, that there will always be Batman stories long after I'm done and I've died. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I relate, I guess, to Brainiac in that way, that I do want there to be a conclusion.
Yeah. That's the thing that Grant Morrison himself has said. He said that characters like Superman are more real than you and I are, because, you know, they have existed before us. People tell their stories long after we're dead. They're real to us at a different level of reality than we are. You know, it's an interesting concept, you know, but they're more well known than we'll ever be.
The thing that no one
walks around
me
with a t-shirt with my face on it.
Yet. Give it time.
you guys need to have merch. You need to have a merch store for the Earth 2 podcast. But the thing that bugs me about the ending of this book is they've realized that the best thing they could do is leave. The Justice League has to leave this evil universe to go back to the regular universe where they always win, because they always win there means they can't win there. And that kind of, for me, kind of undercuts their effectiveness in the real world. And that's kind of just, and I know that we know as readers they're always going to win because they are the heroes, but that's just Grant Morrison saying, well, they're going to win because the universe is on their side and it's fated, and really that kind of takes away some of the stakes. So Grant Morrison is really telling me, like, why would you ever worry that they're not going to win the day? They're living in a universe where literally the laws of the universe dictate that good will triumph over evil. So it does kind of diminish any of their accomplishments.
But the crime syndicate are the heroes that their world needed at that time, because by going back, they defeated Brainiac, they saved both worlds.
But the,
what happened. Johnny Quick saves the Flash. You've got all that. So it's.
But they both are living in a world where there are no stakes because they will always be victorious, whether it's the crime syndicate trying to be evil. They're existing in a world where they will be evil. So don't worry about them. They're going to sleep perfectly fine tonight. And the Justice League is in a universe where they're always going to win because that's the rules of the universe. It does just kind of take away any kind of meaning in their fights.
Well, maybe not, because we saw the tubes in the crime syndicate headquarters that Dave was talking about with Dr. Noon and stuff like that. Were they fallen members of the crime syndicate? Who knows? Superman had died. Wonder Woman had died. Batman had his back broken. I know they all got better, but that's just how it goes. There are you know, fictional stakes.
One thing I noticed from this was that in the sequences where the crime syndicate are going nuts on our Earth, as it were, there's no other superheroes that pop up to try and stop them. It's only just the JLA. I wondered if this story was being told sort of outside of regular continuity in a way. You know, if it was all a bit allegorical or something, you know.
It is kind of, because at the time this came out, September 2000, things had already changed. Lex was already running for president, which isn't mentioned. Batman in this storyline, he's got the yellow oval. He ditched that at the end of No Man's Land, which finished a year before. So I know Frank's quite slow on doing the art, but you know, it might be a deliberate choice. To do that, to make it stand out, make it look a bit different. So maybe it is something that's a bit more obscure. But one of the things I love in this is there are some really, really great moments in it, especially for Batman. Batman actually gets, first of all, to meet a version of his dad. Not only do that, but save his life. I mean, that's, admittedly,
yes,
it's
yes, twisted uh-huh, version,
but that is phenomenal. And it's almost like a throwaway. They don't stay in it too long. But when you think about it, you just go, wow, that's incredible. You know,
that goes back to what
Batman's
I was saying.
Dad is a hero on that earth as opposed to Commissioner Gordon.
But Grant Morrison, I think, really understands that Batman, it's all about family and his connection with his parents, but especially with his dad, and the fact that grown-up Bruce Wayne as Batman gets to meet an older grown-up Thomas Wayne and talk to him man-to-man and team up with them and help, you know, decriminalize Gotham and try to bring down Gordon, who's corrupt in this universe. But on the flip side of that too, Thomas Wayne Jr. as Owlman, his main thing when he first goes into, and I love that we all keep referring to as the DC universe as our universe, but the first thing he does is he goes to Thomas and Martha Wayne's gravestone, and then he realizes, you know, they're dead, and he says, we can't win here, but also he says there's no point for him being here, because he lives to make his father's life a living hell in his universe, and his whole motivation is version of, like, he hates his father just as much as Bruce Wayne loves his father. And when he arrives in our universe and realizes that Thomas Wayne is dead, he's like, what is the point of me even being here if I can't ruin his life and can't be just making things hectic for him?
And I'm not Batman's biggest fan. I mean, I love him to a point. I just feel that in the last 30 years, DC have kind of flogged him to death. but it's occasionally you're sort of reminded in stories like this, you know, no, this is why he's cool. This is why he's good, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See the bit where
I
was going to say, see the scene where he bursts out of at the commissioner's office, and it cuts to, it's snowing, and it cuts to a scene in the alley, and basically it's looking straight up as he comes out the window. That panel is phenomenal. It's ridiculously good. It's just, again, I said it before, cinematic. It just looks as if it should be filmed. It's like all of this, the tone of this actually really reminds me of the animated shows, except maybe a bit more mature, like the Batman animated series. It's like, it's really hard to read Batman's dialogue without reading it in Kevin Conroy's voice.
I actually was reading Batman's dialogue in your Adam West voice, matey.
No, don't do that.
Any time I read a Batman comic now, that's how it works.
not for this one, no.
I would love to see how that plays. Incredible. Peter Watson's take on Batman through Adam West for like a Scott Snyder Batman. We have an episode we just released on Mad Love, and I said the same thing with our guest Ryan Howe, how I can't read a Batman comic without it being Kevin Conroy's voice. But Kale, you said that you only attach his voice to that style that's very much the Batman the Animated Series. What voice did you hear for Owlman, Kale?
I actually, you know, that's a good question. I don't know if you guys watched the movie recently that came out. I think it's an DC animated movie that dealt with Earth 2, and they had James Woods do the voice of Owlman.
Yes.
And I thought that was an interesting choice, but now I kind of hear James Woods when I look at Owlman.
Yes, definitely with you on that one. That was a very good
one. I watched it again in preparation before we had the chat. Yeah. When we did Owlman and when we did GLA 37, sorry, I keep saying that. When we did GLA 29 and 30 and did Owlman, he struck me the way he was drawn. He didn't look like Bruce Wayne or Thomas Wayne. He looked like Peter Lorre, the actor. I'm trying to think who I heard. I mean, it's a funny thing. I can't read a Marvel comic now without hearing Chris Evans and Robert Downey, you know.
Yeah.
I think with Batman, I tend to hear 70s Batman cartoon Adam West. that was the first Batman I was exposed to.
Wow.
I tend to always read him as that. I didn't really read Owl. I didn't really hear Owlman as quite as being particularly snivelly, but I definitely imagined Margot Kidder as Superwoman.
Oh, yes. Evil Margot Kidder.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, because she was Lois Lane, and she's the definitive Lois Lane as far as I'm concerned.
One last thing that I want to mention on writing, and then we'll just see if anyone else has anything to talk about the script. But I really like the opening of the Justice League in action. You know, it kind of reminded me of what I loved about the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek film, where everyone kind of gets like their one moment to shine. Everyone kind of gets like their one thing to do. You know, the Martian Manhunter connects everyone telepathically, so they're all linked up. And then, you know, the Flash runs around and checks everyone's ID when they find this plane that's come from another reality. And, you know, Aquaman's dealing with part of the wreckage that's landed in the ocean. I just thought it was a really cool way of introducing everyone and giving them like their one thing and like showing why they are a team and why everyone is kind of needed. And I think Green Lantern's even got like flying monkeys that he's projected from his power ring. David, Frank Quitely, you said you had some issues with his art. Would you like to elaborate?
Well, it's purely an aesthetic thing. He's a master storyteller. I just think he draws people with lumpy faces, and I can't get past it. I'm sorry, Frank. I really am. I mean, I've got a copy of the collected edition of We Three on one of my shelves over there that one of Peter's colleagues in the shop convinced me to buy years ago because he knows how much I like animals. And I've never read it because it's...
Wow.
Maybe I'll read it now that we've talked about it. Maybe I'll make that my homework.
Well, there we are. If anyone's listening and you haven't heard our episode on We Three, Kale and I both loved it. So, you know, I hope that this is a nice companion piece to that episode as well. So, David, I'd be interested to hear what you thought.
I'll let you know, of course.
Give it a chance. But
I really thought that love for We Three. Yes, We Three love it.
Yes. Yeah. Peter, what's your general take, or is there anything in specific about this book that you thought was really cool art-wise?
Yeah, well, I've mentioned quite a few of the scenes that really stood out. I love how the final image we see of the Justice League in the rain, you've got the reflection of them in the rain, so it mirrors the same as the cover, you know, with like the almost like twisted reflection of the characters underneath before it cuts back to the crime syndicate and finishing off the story with them. I really love that. It's a nice bit of bookending. That was lovely. But yeah, most of the stuff I've mentioned that I really, really enjoyed, things like, as I said, Batman bursting out the window, which is a really subtle panel. I do love the way Vin draws Lex Luthor, because he does look intelligent for a start, but also he looks kind of physically capable. I know he's in that power suit, but you look at his face, it's almost like a wrestler's face. You know, he does look as if he's, you wouldn't want to meet him in a dark alley sort of thing. You know, he could,
it does look as if he's gone through a few rounds with the CSA, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but that's one of the things that gets picked up on, and that's one of the things gets picked up on in All Star Squadron is Lex doing his big workout. You know, say, "Oh, look how strong I am." That's sort of that in a couple of scenes, and you've got Clark in his big baggy suit, just basically pushing his glasses up his face. that's the thing that obviously they really enjoy doing, because that was before, and they decided to carry on doing that. They've liked doing those characters, so yeah, fantastic. But yeah, I really enjoyed his Lex Luthor, but basically all the characters were great. I think just the storytelling in itself is fantastic. The copy I've got that I was reading from has got like the script and some breakdowns at the back of it. So it's interesting to compare them to the actual final thing, because I know Grant quite often, as well as the script, he actually draws it out for himself just so he can picture it better in his head. And I always wonder how those pictures would actually compare with the end product. Because I know some of the projects I've heard that he's done, he basically doesn't even look at the art afterwards and just assumes it all goes well.
Really? He doesn't read the final project. Wow.
Yeah, wow. It's like, because as far as he's concerned, the one he drew is the image that he's got in his head. So
that's, so that's interesting.
But yeah,
that's cool. That's a whole nother level of trust in your artist, but also confidence in your own work that like, no, I've done the version that I like. No one will ever see it. Yeah. But I know that like on my shelf in my office is this really crude, probably thumbnail, really rough draft version, but that's fine for me. And the rest of the world can enjoy Frank Quietly's lovely, gorgeous art or ugly characters, depending on your opinion.
When he first started in comics, he was drawing all his own things. Like he did his own strips for Near Myths, the Scottish magazine. And then he did the Captain Clyde strip that ran for years in the Glasgow local presses.
Yeah.
Which I've got quite a few copies of. You can get it from the Mitchell Library, folks. It's all free there.
Oh, nice.
You can go and look it up and fish. you should definitely seek it out because it is stunning. It's really good, but it's a silly... It's kind of an out-of-place comic strip from then, because people weren't really into superheroes. And he does a lot of the deconstruction in that. Like, you know, he's got this character who gets superpowers, but he's like, he's worried about, you know, he's worried about losing his job. He needs to find a new job. He's chipped a tooth. It's very much real world sort of thing. But he's drawn in this almost proto Jim Starlin style. Obviously, he's doing a lot of Captain Marvel, I think, at the time. But I strongly recommend everyone to try and seek out Captain Clyde because it is great. It ran for about 4 years.
Interesting.
But yeah, it's phenomenal. Sorry, that was a complete tangent, but we're talking about Frank Whiteley's art now. Sorry. Yes. no, but there's so many great scenes. As you said, there's so many good like splash pages, large images. The one that Dave talked about with the Green Lantern, with basically the hands holding the moon, holding everything together, was fantastic. There was a great scene in the villain's headquarters that I loved, which they're in a toilet and it's basically like an old Victorian toilet for no reason. It's insane with like clamshell urinals and stuff like that and sinks.
Yes.
And it's,
yeah, I noticed
so,
that.
So
yeah,
bizarre.
That was interesting.
Very opulent. It reminded me, Kale, I don't know if you've made this connection, but it reminded me of Mr. Burns's bathroom in like one of the early episodes of The Simpsons with like a fountain and he's got like birds flying and it's like an atrium toilet and like music playing.
Yeah, I definitely thought about that. I wanted to mention though, Peter, when you were mentioning Lex Luthor, I thought that Lex Luthor actually looked like the Justice League cartoon Lex Luthor. And there's like, I feel like there's a parallel there that perhaps they're maybe done on purpose or maybe by accident, I'm not sure, but they look so similar when you kind of compare them.
Yeah, it could be an intentional thing. But as I said, when I was reading it, the voices and things I heard from were like characters from the cartoons. It definitely did have the, like, as I said, a more mature version of the animated series flowing through it. But yeah, I can
see Clancy Brown that does the voice in the animated series universe.
He's one of the voices. Yeah. I think he is for that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kale, I, you know, it's hard to talk so much about visuals without just kind of doing a list of like cool visuals that we saw in an audio podcast, but I thought of a cool experiment. I want to try this, Kale. I'll start with Kale and then I'll ask the others a question as well. But Kale, if you saw like a lineup of Batman drawn by different artists, my question is, how would you find the Frank Quietly Batman in this lineup?
That's an easy one. Basically his body would be rounder and he would have bigger lips. I think that's kind of a thing with Frank Quitely's art. Most of his heroes have bigger lips and luscious lips.
Okay. Dave, my question for you is, how would you spot the Wonder Woman in the lineup? How would you know this is Frank Quitely's Wonder Woman?
Legs for years, mate. Legs for years. That's the thing that struck me. Okay, I'm a leg man in real life, I suppose, if we're going to go down that route. But I remember going, yeah, because especially the scenes with Superwoman, but he drew one of the room in the same. Yeah, look for the pins.
And then Peter, how do you find the Frank Quietly Superman?
His Superman looks like he's wearing clothes. It's not like his body is just colored the color of the costume. Actually, it looks like it's fabric on him. It's really, really cool. That you actually see seams on like the arms and things like that. There is so much detail in it and so much thought goes into it. It is a costume that he puts on. It's not literally just like, these are my muscles and this is the way my body's going. Except this is blue and there's an S in my chest. It looks like it could be some. It looks like, you know, it could be George Reeves. It looks, you know, more than anyone else, really. His version.
I liked the way how he drew Superman's very pronounced kiss curl.
Yes, that was nice. I mean, it's a classic look, nice, and he does stick with the classics.
It does feel like they're kind of stuffed into their suits. Like they feel like they got really puffed up chests, and like they're almost all. Everyone looks like they're about to burst out of whatever clothing they're wearing, whether it is a superhero costume or, you know, Clark Kent in his suit and tie and jacket. Like everyone looks like they don't quite fit, and I kind of like that sort of, you know, I don't know if it's bursting with energy or just too puffy for the world, but they're not, I don't know. I like that everyone's not like a perfect statuesque, you know, he's got that detail. So it is a little bit of an uglification of the characters. And I do like that, you know, I like that you can open a book and say, oh, wow, that's definitely Frank Quitely's work. I like that it's very distinctive, whether you like it or not, but you can tell he has a signature, look.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, it's that it's softer clothing, and it doesn't seem like the person's kind of vacuum sealed into their costume, you know, where you can actually see every muscle or, any every contour kind of thing. It's like, oh, he's wearing clothes on top of his, you know, normal build, right? So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
I've got a question for everyone as well. Just as we're talking about alternate universes, and your podcast definitely deals with alternate realities, I was just going to ask, like, Pete, do you have a favorite alternate reality in comics, whether it's DC or Marvel? One of those ones where you can really pick apart and, like we said, like find the differences, spot the differences?
Yeah, well, the main one, the main parallel universe that we're looking at on our podcast, funnily enough, is Earth 2, but not this Earth 2, the original Earth 2. And that is
comics. You know, it's just so straightforward.
Yeah, that's but yeah, I think, and I'm pretty sure Dave will say the same. But yeah, because that's where all the GSA came from, the All-Star Squadron came from. Everything was built from the characters that were created that then were put into their own universe. All the stuff we read in comics these days is built on those foundations, and they're the originals. They're the best because of that. And yeah, and basically in the 60s, they kind of decided we could get rid of them because we have replaced quite a few of the characters. But instead they thought, no, let's have our cake and eat it. We can have two Flashes. We can have two Green Lanterns. We can have two Atoms. But they don't have to be the same. You know, the original Atom's this short guy who was quite strong and a bit handy with his fists. Let's make the new Atom a guy that can shrink to the size of an atom. Okay, right. But yeah, so they basically had their cake and ate it. It's fantastic. So the original Earth 2 universe is great. And there we are. And that's why we took that name for our podcast.
That makes sense. Dave, are you the same? Is that your favorite alternate reality, or do you have another one?
My learned colleague is absolutely right. I mean, especially in comics. I was growing up in the 80s, I was a big fan of Marvel's What If series, but my favorite would definitely be was DC's original sort of Earth 2 universe. Because when I was a little boy, you know, I mean, I'm 48 now. when I was like 5 or 6 and I was being bought, you know, the American comics from the spinner rack in the shop opposite my grandmother's and all that, I remember very clearly getting the first JLA JSA team up story that I'd ever read. And I was fascinated by this more interesting version of Green Lantern and this more interesting version of the Flash, who were suddenly there. Flash wore a Mercury helmet and a blue trousers, Green Lantern had blonde hair and wore a red shirt. Looked so different to the guys who I was used to. And I've never lost that fascination. And as I got a bit older and read a bit more about comics and learned that these were the original characters published in the 40s, that, you know, that cemented my love for the Golden Age. And that's my prime mover. And what we're doing, it's like it's a celebration of these really as Pete said, the foundation for everything that's been built. These original Golden Age characters are just so much more interesting.
Yeah, my favorite reality is Earth 30 with Superman Red Sun. I thought that was a really cool like twist on a story that, I don't know, I'm a bit of a political junkie as well. So for me, it's just like, oh, what if, you know, Superman landed in Russia? It's kind of cool. It's a cool concept. Hopefully we'll get more stories from there. But yeah, I really enjoyed that reality.
Yeah, I definitely want to cover that graphic novel for a future episode. Superman Red Sun is awesome. For me, I was going to say Mutant X. So in like late 90s, maybe, or again, early 2000s, Alex Summers, Havoc, who's Cyclops' brother, was catapulted to an alternate reality. And he was a member of like this kind of darker version of the X-Men, where Iceman's powers were out of control and he couldn't touch anyone. And the Beast blew himself up in an experiment trying to become human, became even more monstrous, and also lost his intellect. And Storm was a vampire, and Angel was like not even an archangel, but like this kind of twisted demon angel with like bat wings. And everything was just a little bit off. But like every issue, they encountered someone that Havoc and we recognize, but is just different enough. Like, and you have to kind of play catch up. And we and him are always kind of try to figure out like what's different, what's happened here, and where's the split. So I always but it was funny too, because when I was reading them, I didn't have the first issue, so I really was just kind of thrown into the middle of it with like issue 2 and 3. So I didn't even know how we got there, and so it was just a really cool, you know, identification with that character of also just being complete. Like, what is going on, and what's the difference here?
I got hold of a full set of Mutant X a couple of years ago at a really, really reasonable price on eBay, and that's reminded me that they've been in my priority to read pile for a very long time, and I haven't got anywhere near them. So that's maybe that'll spur me on. Something else.
How big is this pile?
After I read Wii 3. Oh, it's huge, man. when I say pile, I mean piles, several, you know. And several piles in several rooms.
I don't know if it's similar to you guys. And Kale, I don't know. We haven't even talked about this between us. But now that we're doing this podcast and we have like this kind of, you know, we're releasing them every 2 weeks, but we're trying to bank as many as we can just in case we have to take some off ones. And also I have a kid on the way, so I'm going to take a bit of a paternity leave. But it does feel a little bit like the only comics I'm reading are like, I've got to read this because it's like homework and I got to get it done in time for the podcast. And so I'm still buying stuff. I'm still collecting stuff. And it's just sitting, waiting until I have a break from this podcast, which is now I have to read stuff specifically for this podcast. It's a weird thing.
Yeah. We're in exactly the same boat. Exactly the same.
We've been trying to take advantage of lockdown and bank as many as we can. I've managed to squeeze a little bit more of sort of recreational reading in whilst we've been doing it. I've been reading the DC Comics event from 96, The Final Night, recently. I just took a notion to read all that through again. I hadn't read it since it was published, and I just took a notion. But it's fun. I mean, a lot of the stories that Pete and I are doing for our podcast, rather shamefully, you know, I've had them for years, decades in some cases, and I haven't read any of them before. We recorded one recently. We did issue 45 of Green Lantern from 66, and I've owned it for years and I've never read it, which is shameful. So don't, Matt, don't worry about your to-read pile being huge. Mine stretches back to the 90s. You know, it's like I've still got that full run of Superman Family that I bought in 1994 that I haven't got anywhere near. So don't worry about it.
Well, my plan is when the kid is around and he's a baby, like he's not going to know what I'm reading. So I might as well read comics out loud, because like it's just to hear the sound of my voice. And then hopefully that will foster a love of comics when he is ready to understand what's going on. So that's my dream, is that when if I am reading a story for bedtime, it'll be just whatever daddy wants to read because he's just hearing sounds. Yeah. Kale, any last questions?
Get Peter,
before we
get
wrap
Peter
up?
And I on Zoom, and we'll do some of the voices for you.
Oh, that's a good idea.
What was it like to encounter Grant Morrison or Frank Quitely in real life, in person?
Have you guys run into them? Because they're all everyone's from Glasgow.
Yeah.
Who wants? You go first, then, Peter.
Okay. They're both good friends of the owner of Forbidden Planet. So we have popped in from time to time, and we have got chatting from time to time. So yeah, I kind of know them a wee bit. when Grant was doing his Super Gods book, my boss got a copy of one of the proof copies of it. And said, do you want to have a read at this? I went, yes. So I was reading through, and then I was like, oh, hang on, that's not right. Oh, hang on, that's not right. Oh, no. But it was just like a proof copy. So I was literally saying, how long have we got, you know, before this has to go somewhere? I was doing notes and passing them back. But it was all stuff, you know, that they pretty much got, because this is just like first draft sort of thing. But yeah, it was great to be just kind of like involved in that process of just like trying to help out a bit. And it made me want to like read the whole thing a lot quicker. But yeah, that was cool.
It's a very good book, yeah.
Yeah, and that was Grant. So we've met him a few times. And Vin as well. One time, the shop had Paul Cornell in for a signing, who's a Doctor Who writer and written loads of comics and things. He was in for a signing, and we ended up going to the pub with him. A few more people came along. That was cool. Then we ended up going out for a meal, and it was myself, it was Paul Cornell, it was Frank Whiteley, there was Gary Erskine. It was a whole Hope Street artist crowd. We're all there, awesome. All just randomly. And it's like, I've just thought I'd go out for a drink, but now I'm like sitting here having an Indian with like some of the top talent in comics around.
Yeah.
So that was a surreal night, but a lot of fun. Yeah, Gary Erskine was telling all these big anecdotes, and I was sitting across from Vin, and we were just looking at each other going, what? What's this? Where's he going with this one? Have you heard this one? Have I heard this one? No, okay.
Gary can talk though. Gary can talk for Scotland. I love him.
I know.
But he could. But yeah. He was in. I remember once. I used to work in HMV, and Gary was in once, and he obviously drew a few issues of Starman, and I remember speaking to him sort of about that and getting looks from my supervisor because I spent so long talking to this guy, and I was like, I'm trying to get away. Bless him.
And of course, Vin did some work for the New Forbidden Planet shop in Glasgow. He did a lot of the design work for that there. He did a recreation of his All-Star Superman, which greets you as you come in the door. It's like massive, massive wall frieze as you come in the door, and there's lots of like homage artwork going up the walls. Like, you know, the famous meme of Batman slapping Robin. That was originally done by Kurt Swan. Basically, Vin got it blown up so that he could do a version of it for the shop. But when it was blown up, basically it was pixelated too much. So what he did, basically, he had to go over the whole thing. So technically it's really a Kurt Swan image that's been inked by Frank Whiteley.
Amazing.
So yeah, they did that. He also did a bit of live art kind of like for us in the shop, and that's towards the back of the shop. They've got this display marked up as the Monarch Theatre, you know, the place where Bruce and his family went that fateful night. And there's a lamppost that's been set up right beside it, and basically got two of the members of staff to lie down and did chalk outlines around them to be the two dead Wayne parents. And then did like the spray can, literally the day before we opened. He was.
I didn't realize that's a piece of Frank Quietly art. I didn't know that he did the outlines.
I know. He didn't initially or anything. No one knows. They're just like, oh, look at that.
And I'm had to lie on the ground.
It was Victoria.
It wasn't Kevin and Jim, was it?
Oh, can you imagine? No, it was Victoria and I think it was James. I think.
Right.
Yeah.
I see. Cool.
But that was hilarious. Awesome. But literally the day before we opened.
Brilliant.
And Dave, have you run into them?
I'm not sure I've ever spoken to Frank directly. I've met Grant a few times. Like he did a signing in the shop for Super Gods, which was great. I mean, the book is phenomenal. That was about 10 years ago now. And that was fun. I remember getting a couple of things signed by him at a Comic Mart in Glasgow in the late 90s and kind of chatting to him about what was happening with the JSA and the original Captain Marvel and all that sort of stuff. And because he was writing JLA, and I was, I remember asking him if he was ever going to use them. And he ended up using them in a JLA JSA team up story, which delighted me. When the DC series 52 was going on, you know, the weekly series, and walking down Buchanan Street and seeing Jim, who's, you know, one of the owner of FP, standing outside the shop and talking to Grant. And I kind of, you know, Jim waved me over because, you know, we've known each other for a long time. So, stopped and said hello to Jim and had a quick gossip about a couple of things. And then I turned to Grant and I said, what's Skeets up to then? And he said, I'm not going to tell you. You have to read it. And I said, well, you know, okay, that's fine. I said, listen, I'm loving it. I'm really enjoying it. It's given me the DC tingles that I haven't had for a while. It's great. Cheers. And Jim told me afterwards that Grant was delighted because all he ever got was people coming up to him and giving him abuse. So he was really pleased that someone in the street actually had something nice to say.
Awesome. Well, guys, thanks so much. It was really fun having you on. It was really fun talking about this book and talking about the multiverse and DC and hearing about your podcast. Where can people find the Earth 2 podcast and social media? What do you guys have?
Yeah, well, the podcast is probably best going to the earth2podcast.podbean.com. That's the main link. On social media, we're at the Earth 2 podcast, all one word, on Facebook and Instagram. And on Twitter, we're at podcast_Earth2, and it's the number 2 instead of TWO in all our social media. So yep. Yeah, find us there.
We're on Apple Podcasts as well, obviously. That's what you can also find my other podcast there as well, The Power of Three. And I should give a shout out to my friend Tom Harris, who I do that with. His podcast, The Imposter, is also doing the rounds at the moment. That's worth checking out as well.
And we will link to all your social media and provide links. Kale, where can people find us online?
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Matt and Kale Read Comics, or on Twitter at Matt and Kale Read.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. We are looking at Fortune and Glory, an autobiographical graphic novel by one of my favorite comic book writers of all time, Brian Michael Bendis. Bendis has written for Avengers comics, X-Men comics. He's now working exclusively with DC, writing Superman and a bunch of other titles. But this is a true story of when he tried to adapt one of his own creator-owned graphic novels into a feature film, and just the process of how it went about, him pitching the script, him trying to take on notes, and just the frustrations of writing the script and just waiting around and dealing with studio executives. It's a really cool glimpse behind the scenes of the film industry. And we are joined by another one of my best friends, Ed Moline, who has been working in the film industry for many years. Ed and I went to high school together, but he's coming on the episode to share his experiences and his insights into the entire process of creating film and television, the pitching process, going through different drafts of the scripts. We're really excited to have Ed on. It's a really great graphic novel, Fortune and Glory by Brian Michael Bendis. We are so excited to read that book in 2 weeks. So join us in 2 weeks for that episode. Thanks so much to David Steele and Peter Watson from the Earth 2 podcast. Kale, thanks so much. We'll see you soon.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.